Well, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Dr. Patrick O'Reilly, and the Psychology Forum of the Commonwealth Club is delighted that Dr. Sheldon Cardner has agreed to speak for us. I actually contacted Dr. Cardner several days ago and asked him what he would like me to say in his introduction. He's a very well-accomplished man, and he said, please make it short and simple. So I'm going to do that. That your humility was genuinely touching. You're the first one who ever said that. So, but I do want to say that Dr. Cardner is a psychiatrist and clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of California, Los Angeles. And for over 40 years, he has taught and practiced psychotherapy, with a particular interest in couples therapy. His book, Breaking Free, which I actually have a copy of, it's an excellent book, and coincidentally, it's for sale out there. Anyway, his book is a distillation of his professional experiences, and so please welcome Dr. Cardner.
Thank you. Fire up the... Ooh, boy, that's loud. Fire up the thrusters, Scotty. We've got to reach warp speed. I don't have any idea what that means, but I've always wanted to say it, so I just did. But indeed, we're going to try to condense a great deal of material in a short period of time, and I will keep an eye on the clock, which is very evident here, so that we have some time for questions about the topic. At the insistence of my wife, who has heard me speak before, she demanded that I make notes, because usually I have free form, and the result is what she calls ambling. So what we have set out for ourselves, that was supposed to have changed the slide.
Right.
Didn't?
3 o'clock.
3 o'clock? Different 3 o'clock. I held it upside down, so it was 9 o'clock. What we have... outlined is some of these points of why do our best intentions go awry? What prompts people to engage in behaviors that have the opposite effect than intended? What attracts us to our partners and then create problems and may lead to disillusion only to find going from frying pan to fire, going to a subsequent relationship and having the same conflicts recur? And what contributes to distress not only within a person, within a couple, within a family, and I would by extension suggest, with a great deal of humility, I really mean that, that we can also look at this theme in communities and between nations, and we'll see the same phenomenon occurring. And what this one task that I do want as a take-home message, and that is that behavior is explicable. It's understandable. That does not mean condonable. That does not mean excusable. That does not mean endorsed. It means it can be understood. And I told Aviva on our way in, we saw, and some of you may have seen him, a homeless man sitting on the sidewalk outside, rocking back and forth. And I said, he's in my talk, Aviva. Because in fact, at the turn of the late 1800s, there was a patient in Switzerland who sat in a catatonic schizophrenic. There was no question about that. But he sat rocking hour after hour after hour, just like that man on the street outside today as we walked in, and maybe even when you walk out, and kept repeating 93. Crazy, right? Until it was realized that every telegraph pole in Switzerland is numbered. And the number of the telegraph pole outside of the home where he was raised as a child and physically and sexually abused was 93. Brilliant. That in that condensation, how brilliantly his mind, psychotic though it may have been, was to capture in 93 the essence of horror and terror. I think that it's also, when we were commenting and talking outside before, I think that one of the major problems that Freud encountered was he was saying to 19th century rational man, hey, you have forces within yourself about which you have no knowledge or idea that will contribute to what you do. And that was a tough pill to swallow. And in fact, remains a tough pill to swallow. I think one of the things that is extremely important to keep in mind is a difference, and I've found this very helpful. It was a supervisor of mine when I was in training. The difference between autistic with a small a, I'm not talking about the autistic syndrome, but autistic meaning not communicative, like this guy rocking 93, crazy, what we call crazy, not in a technical term. Yes, he was schizophrenic, but crazy, it's sort of a lay term of what we don't understand. Or we look at some piece of art, or we hear some piece of music, and it does not speak to us. It does not arouse anything. And that is autistic communication. It could be music, poetry, art, conversation. Doesn't matter what the form of the communication is. If it speaks to us, if we get a response, we may be madder than hell about it. But if we have a response, that's artistic. The moment we understood what 93 meant, that communication became artistic, no longer autistic. And so it is with all of human behavior. It isn't random, it isn't capricious, it isn't meaningless. There is a meaning, and it may take some struggle for an individual to understand what those forces are and how they came to be and how they influence us. And we go on here to the very essence. We are born, it's so obvious that we lose track of it very easily. We are born in an utter state of helplessness. Now, infants come from the factory hardwired for about half of the personality. We understand that in terms of nature. And it makes it all the more important, nurture then, to develop that nature in a way that's most productive within the society. We also understand from all of the studies that are going on with infants that they come with some incredible apps as well. And any of you who saw 60 Minutes yesterday know what I'm talking about, the baby lab reports. Just astounding. And we've known that infants know the difference between proper grammar. They will turn away if the word order is incorrect. And it doesn't matter what the language is. But if the word order is incorrect, they'll turn away from it. So, and in the 60 Minute program, they talked and reported about morality, and there's no question. All you have to do is ask a secular humanist or an atheist. You don't need religion for morality. We come hardwired with it. We can stomp it out, but infants come with it. But we are born in a helpless state. And one of the things that's most obvious is that the alternative to making a bond with a caretaker, which is going to be mom most often, is the dumpster. And unfortunately, and I can tell you because I've used this example in lecturing over the years, that about every 9 to 12 months, there was an item in the newspaper somewhere in California, an infant put in a trash can, put in a waste disposal in a bathroom, etc. The California legislature, in a rare stroke of brilliance, passed a law that said any woman can turn in a newborn within 72 hours and walk away. And they defined a limited number of to whom that newborn could be turned into. But it's been expanded to anybody who will accept the child, and the mother can walk away within that 72 hours. A brilliant move. And I can tell you it's cut down but not eliminated the ways in which kids still are abandoned. And we still get reports. Maybe it now is about every 2 years. It seems to me, just thinking about it, that it's about every 2 years or so we still will hear a report. We are also born prematurely. A full-term, nine-month baby is premature. It was thought, it's premature, why? Because one quarter of the human brain is developed at birth, where our chimp cousins and most mammals have at least three quarters maturity of their brain. And so we have this tremendous state of immaturity given what then is going to become the development of the human brain. The argument for a long time was that this had simply to do with mechanics. There is a ring formed by the sacrum and the pelvic bone and the pubis that is a hard limit to the birth canal. But in point of fact, recently there's been some work to indicate that you only need 1 inch more to accommodate the appropriate size for a more mature 1 inch diameter, and you can figure that out in terms of circumference, in order to accommodate a larger head. So why isn't there a larger head when, in fact, studies have shown women do have that capacity? Yes, some women have very small birth canals, and those are women for whom cesarean section certainly are necessary in terms of delivery. But it's thought now that perhaps there's another explanation, and that is metabolic. That the metabolic rate of a pregnant woman at 6 months pregnancy is twice the normal rate. If that continued for 18 months, there would be no mother left. There, as is, there's a little left after a few nights of a newborn. But there's the amount of energy that would be required would be beyond the capacity of the human. So that's a very interesting variation to help explain why we have this premature birth. When we have this kind of absolute necessity for a connection, we hope that the connection is loving, supportive, encouraging, endorsing, positive. We'll take whatever we can get, because the dumpster, no survival is the option. And when we have no option, something very interesting happens. We idealize what we have. If we have no option, we don't need an option, because what I've got is perfect. It's ideal. And so I'm suggesting to you that those early bonds, whatever the nature of the whole panoply of cues, I'm calling the need system with a capital N. So I'm using the word a little differently than ordinary use. We develop and internalize a need system. And you can recognize it very quickly. Just take a child away from, or if you're in a mall and a kid has been lost, it didn't take long for them to act as if they're on the Gobi Desert. If they don't have the familiarity of a parental cue, they're lost. And no matter how much, and I remember seeing a picture of a cop with an ice cream cone desperately trying to get some bawling infant or some bawling toddler attention, because the kid was totally panicked. He had lost his mother. And that's a part of this powerful need system. Now, needs are neutral. They're neither good nor bad. They are what they are. And sometimes we all could wish that they would be better for a lot of people than a lot of people end up having. But they're invested with the power of survival. Without that need, we don't survive. Without that need cue being fulfilled, we don't survive. And that makes it very, very powerful. So powerful that, in fact, it ought not recur in adult life. It should only be at the time of toddler, infant, toddler. But in fact, it does reoccur in susceptible individuals. And it recurs so dramatically that it's been labeled the Stockholm Syndrome. Are you familiar with the Stockholm Syndrome? Anyone not? Be happy to quickly. Okay. A bank robbery in Stockholm took hostages. Hostages were held for an extended period of time. The police finally broke in. This, by the way, this pattern was repeated in a number of places. A terrorist hijacked an El Al airline and parked it in the Libyan desert and was shooting in the head a passenger every hour if they didn't give the Israeli Special Forces went in and freed the remaining hostages. But in the bank situation, the rescuers, the Stockholm police, when they broke in, were shocked to find some of the hostages defending the bank robbers. He just needed money for his grandmother's operation. He's a good guy, etc. All of the idealization. Why? Because the life of that person, like an infant, was totally dependent upon the hostage taker. When you have that, no option. It's up to them whether they pull the trigger or not. Your life is in their hands. You have the replication for susceptible individuals of infants with a mother. And idealization then occurs. And that was the stunning thing with the Stockholm syndrome that was found. Now, what the needs that I've described may include very positive aspects. They can be aspects of honesty, integrity, a way of dealing with people in a moral and upright fashion. Those are all needs, but those needs then get converted with growth to the adult wants. So need, as I'm using it, is the panoply of signals that cue a person to survival, parts of which then, if desired, are turned into wants of the adult. And we'll get to that in a moment. But I want to emphasize something more. A colleague, in fact, he was almost single-handedly responsible for influencing the change in the law in California about abortions. Abortions were illegal in the 60s in California, and Jerry Kummer worked very hard to change that law and succeeded. And he was at a conference about drug use among youngsters, and there was a panel conference, and one of the speakers was a young fellow who ran a YMCA program. And he said, in the course of his enthusiasm, he said, "I've never seen any of our people be helped by a shrink." And then suddenly it hits him, there's a shrink on the panel. And so he leans forward and he says, "Oh, Dr. Kummer, I'm terrible." He was sort of a loss, and Jerry was a fabulous guy. And he said, "Oh, no, don't worry. That's okay. Believe me." And these are the words that you can bank on in terms of the human condition. "I'd rather be kicked than ignored." Because to be ignored is incompatible, for this reason and for us being social creatures, it's incompatible with survival. That's why I would suggest to you that solitary confinement is cruel and unusual punishment. Apartheid that was used in the South African regime is cruel and unusual punishment. It was designed to cut people off from any social interactions. In the ancient times, one was exiled as a punishment. Do you know where the word exile comes from? Ex ilium, to be disemboweled. So to be exiled from your home, to be cut off, was not to be able to survive in the ancient world. One of the other things, too, that's stunning, a fellow named King Frederick II of Sicily, was one of the pretenders to the Holy Roman Empire, a brilliant guy, apparently, and quite interested in science, gruesome human experimentations that he conducted to satisfy curiosity, one of which was he wanted to know what the native tongue would be. What language do infants speak if unspoken to and uninfluenced? So he instructed the caretakers, under no circumstances would they make any sounds in caring for the babies. And then we would know, was it Hebrew, Greek, Latin, whatever. What was going to emerge as the native tongue? Well, King Frederick never found out. All the kids died because when you restrict a caretaker from having interaction, they withdraw, and the child withers. And so King Frederick's experiment was somewhat reported on also by Rene Spitz in an unnamed South American country where infants were cared for by too few caretakers, but in very clean, hygienic circumstances. But the caretakers could only feed, change, feed, change, feed, change, go from crib to crib. He used that population, it's an unknown or unnamed South American country, because he then compared to mothers who were in prison and who had infants and children and filthy circumstances, very hygienically poor, to say the least, as you can well imagine, and then showed photographs, and the work is stunning. The Spitz kids, the ones raised in the state-run, but no time to play with or pay attention to, were shriveled in comparison to the healthy normals that they were compared to, age for age. It's stunning, the stunted growth. Ceausescu left us a similar heritage with the Romanian orphanage children, and studies now on them are showing severe neural pathway abnormalities. Because again, you have to have that human connection. The Dalai Lama, I wanted to make sure to mention this just as a change in emphasis, or perhaps as an exclamation mark. The Dalai Lama was asked, how do you account for your extraordinary compassion? Is it your Tibetan culture? Is it your Buddhist faith? Is it perhaps reincarnation? And he laughed, as only you inimitably know that he could. He said, oh, no, my mother. Give your children maximum care, maximum love. And if you can, I can't mimic his voice, but if you've heard him, you know how it sounded. And it's very true. Let's take a peek inside. This is an extraordinary plant, 3 pounds in adult weight, that has at birth some 100 billion neurons and trillions of connections. I saw a fact somewhere on, I didn't write it down, so I can't quote it exactly, but that a human brain has more switches, if you consider each connection a switch, than all of the internet connections and all of the computers in the entire world in one brain. So it's a phenomenal plant, to say the least. But it has to be pruned. And the way in which it's pruned is the environment and maternal interaction and significant others. So again, as I said, while we know that kids come hardwired from the factory, that's all the more important reason why nurture plays into nature in terms of how you prune, how you develop that brain. And it goes by a name called Hebb's Law, H-E-B-B-S. Hebb's Law says simply that neurons that fire together wire together, so that as circuits are reinforced, that's how those circuits that are not used are dissipated and changed and become pruned. I'm going to borrow from a colleague, Dan Siegel, a very simple, and you can all try this if you wish, but I'll demonstrate it. If you think of this, my thumb, as the midbrain structures, and you put your thumb against your palm, and then if you think of the cortex of the brain wrapping around, you have a picture of how intimately close the right orbital frontal cortex comes to midbrain structures. And it is that intense connection between the emotional centers and the thinking and feeling part of the brain. What we've come to understand from research is that right orbital prefrontal cortex is what connects a mother and an infant. They communicate through that. And in fact, what King Frederick never realized or appreciated is that there is a native tongue that we do speak in quotes, and that is nonverbal. I've often thought that there's a Nobel Prize for someone who can delineate the vocabulary of that nonverbal language. because it is the way in which we communicate. Only about 10%, roughly, it varies depending on who studies, are verbal content. Tone and body language are the most powerful. And that study was originally done by a guy at UCLA in the School of Business Administration. When your client leans back away from you, lean forward. Maintain the closeness. That was one of the ideas of the communication. So much of it is so powerfully nonverbal and tonal. And if any of you have read depositions, you recognize quickly that you could read a deposition and have no idea what's truly being said because you don't have tone and you don't have body language. And so that all but 10% of the communication is eliminated. And I think that is the language that we come back to in terms of the power of the connection. When we talk about empathy between people, it is that right prefrontal orbital cortex that's connecting to others. It's been thought that the seat of transference and countertransference in the therapy relationship occurs at that level as well, and predominantly and powerfully nonverbally. We also know, and there's recent work of mirror neurons. The job of a mirror neuron is to do just that, mirror behaviors, mimic. See the behavior, monkey see, monkey do. And sure enough, monkeys have mirror neurons. Wonder if people do. Sure enough, people do. And so there is a powerful sense in which that communication takes form in terms of the brain. I said before that system that I referred to, and I'll go back to you, is the need system, and it's neutral. And with growth and development, it becomes, and in the far left, we have large C, meaning the needs of a child, over the beginning emerging of adult. Even in a toddler or a newborn or a youngster, there's the emerging adult. I'm talking about states of mind, and I'm going to characterize those states for you just very shortly. And I better do it quickly. And then adolescence is characterized by this kind of split, and you can hear that among adolescents. I don't need anybody to watch me. I can stay home by myself. Where are you going? What time will you be back? And how can I reach you? Well, it's almost in one sentence. You can hear both aspects of the dependence and the emerging adult. And then for the lucky few, the adult predominates, and by adult I'm talking about a state of mind free of the encumbrances of past problems. But there's always a residual part of us that's an unresolved conflict. All of us have it. Why? Because there are no perfect people. Don't need perfect people. We need good enough, as a fellow named Winnicott coined. You need good enough parenting. That's all that's needed. But there's going to be a residual conflicted aspect that doesn't get converted. It's a question I sometimes ask students. Are psychoanalysts interested in the past? And I won't belabor it by asking you how many think psychoanalysts are interested in the past. And the answer, of course, is a trick question. The answer is no, of course not. If it's past, of what interest is it? What is of interest is what ought to be past and isn't. And that's what we focus on in the process of growth and in the process of therapy, is what ought to be past that isn't. So if we then have this tension between what we needed that is unresolved in terms of transforming it into adult wants, what we have as a residual need conflicting with what we want as an adult. It's that interface that conflict develops at. It's that tectonic form. In San Francisco, I can speak of tectonic plates. So we have that force that that is the junction of conflict between what it is we want, which is very nice, but not invested with survival, and not invested with another aspect, We all desire, since we are, as far as we know, the only animal that has an idea we're going to die, we'd like to know what tomorrow is going to bring. One of the ways you can know what's going to be tomorrow is if you keep yesterday the same as today, then you can predict tomorrow. So one of the things that not only is need related to the unresolved need that's residual, related to early survival, but it's also a way of trying to have predictability. If we keep everything the same, be it ever so miserable, there's no place like home. And I think that's a motto I've often thought that that sampler would sell. So we have then two states of mind. A state of mind that represents the adult in real time, free of the burden of past conflicts that haven't been resolved, and then the child part of ourselves. All of us under stress, under pressure, can fall back to old states. All of us have that potential of regression. All it took when the Russians went into Hungary with Cardinal Menzenti, who was a avowed anti-communist, was simply no protein and no sleep. And after a short period of time, it's what the cults did in the late 60s and 70s, no protein and no sleep. And then you have putty in your hands. So they didn't have to use a rubber truncheon on Cardinal Menzenti. There's no protein, no sleep, and he was putty in their hands. So all of us can regress back to a childlike state. These are some characteristics, and I'm going to go through them very quickly. The first, confirmation versus validation. A parent can validate a child. An adult can only validate themselves. They look for confirmation of that validation, but they cannot get it from another person when they're an adult. You get it, you deserve it, from a parent, but you cannot get it as an adult from anybody but yourself. Doesn't matter how many people tell you you're okay. If you don't believe it, you ain't going to experience it. But the confirmation of it, and one of the best examples of what I'm talking about is the Wizard of Oz with the Straw Man, the Tin Man, and the Lion joined Dorothy to go to Oz because they all want something very special. I won't go through all those features that you remember if you saw the movie, and I'm sure you did. And Toto pulls the curtain back and reveals a total charlatan, and they're devastated. But then he says to them, look at what each of you demonstrated to get here. You all had the thing you're asking me for. You've already had it and didn't acknowledge it. Second one is, I'm going to spend a little more time on that, is analog versus binary thinking. This is crucial because our minds do not work in an analog. By analog, I mean a dimmer switch. That there's a range of positions between on and off. Binary, or digital, is a light switch, on or off, yes or no, good or bad. That's binary. That's normal thinking up until early adolescence, when analog thinking then begins to take place. Analog thinking is this range between extremes of a whole range of choices. When people are locked in a conflict, they're in a binary mode. It's almost a time stamp that says where it's coming from, childhood. Because almost nothing is absolute in binary sense. Almost nothing that you can think of. Maybe death and taxes, I suppose. But even the absolutes of that is very interesting. A random thought. There are times when physicians cannot determine when death has occurred. And this becomes extremely important in terms of organ transplant. When is the person deceased so that organs can be harvested? So it's even there, it's not so clear-cut. Studies have shown that about 70% of adults, by adult, I'm using a small a, not the state of mind adult, operate in a binary mode. That's pretty stunning. Until you read the front page or listen to CNN, even Fox News, or MSNBC. Then you see how much of the world is operating in a binary mode, how much of our Congress is operating in a binary mode, how much of our political system, how much sound bites are binary. You don't take the time to explain. You want to hit quick. We're good, they're bad. You want to get that message through. That's binary. And it grabs. It grabs because it touches this very early part of our thought process. St. Ignatius is credited with having said, give me a child until they're seven and I will give you the man. Just again to emphasize the power of that early experience. By the way, Proverbs, for those of you who want to look it up, it's 22:6. Start a boy on the right road, and even in old age, he will not leave it. We've heard some binary conversations in this last election. We heard it with, you're either with me or against me. We hear it frequently. Picture any of the stands, Afghanistan, Pakistan. It's easier when we're not thinking of our own culture to picture the tribal, the absolutist, the role of women. All of that is binary. There is no Malali in Pakistan who was shot for wanting an education. That represents analog thinking. Doesn't fit into the binary. Girls don't get educated. Boys do. Wait a minute, half your population? What are you thinking? I'm not thinking, I'm reacting. I'm reacting from one of the stands. And I think that's true of almost all of the stands, except for Stanford, I suppose. That we hope would be a little different. So I would suggest to you that confusion and uncertainty are the midwives that give birth to the adult. One of the definitions of maturity is the ability to tolerate uncertainty. We don't like that. We get very uncomfortable. But that is maturity. Let me go on just to highlight some of these. I'm not going to discuss about each of them. But I do want to talk about vulnerable versus helpless. Remember, we're talking about adult state of mind versus child state of mind. When we are kids, helplessness and vulnerability are welded together. There is no difference. I would suggest to you, and I suggest to you strongly, as I do to my patients, that the two are no longer ever synonymous. That an adult may be enormously vulnerable, but is never, never helpless. There's always an option. There's always a choice. I used to use a more macabre and regrettable that in its devastating impact, examples of the Holocaust and victims who died in the concentration camps, those who died feeling helpless, those who died feeling vulnerable. But I can update that to a more contemporary, unfortunate, but powerful example, and that's United 93. I have no doubt in my mind that there were passengers aboard that flight who curled up in a fetal position and regressed to a childlike, not childish, childlike, childish is a pejorative, a childlike state. But there were those who said, we may be doomed, but we're not helpless. We have an option. And they exercised it. And just to complete the presentation, these are some additional characteristics that I defined, and we won't go through them for time's sake, except to emphasize again the want versus need, the capacity to bring to the fore what it is we want, even if it means overriding the need. Why do we hold on to the need? There's another reason. I mentioned to you that it was imbued with survival. I mentioned to you that it was imbued with the power of predictability. If you keep everything the same as yesterday, you can predict. There are other factors that play into that as well. And I want to illustrate that, and I will with some case to move ahead. Let me move on now to discuss with you conflicts. Conflicts have some general rules. One of the first general rule is what isn't felt out is acted out. I have colleagues, and there's a whole school that's called ahistoric, or Fritz Perls founded Gestalt therapy. You don't have to ask about history. I admire those people because I need that information to help me get oriented. But what Fritz Perls and others of the ahistorical school indicate is that whatever you need to know is happening in the immediacy of the moment. So a person will say, no, I had a perfect childhood, and I had wonderful parents, and there was never any conflict. You know, that just ain't true. As I tell such people, I'd love to meet your folks because I've never met a parent who wasn't once a child. And if you have a parent who wasn't once a child, I'd love to meet them and talk with them. So the idea then that what isn't felt out is acted out. If you can think of it as a hydraulic chamber, if you push down important feelings, something's got to come up, and what comes up is behavior. The body may also be a vehicle for the expression of unexpressed feelings. But if they are important feelings, you can push them down, but they will come up as behavior. And if you look at the behavior, it will tell you what the conflicts is, what the conflicts are. So you, in a sense, you don't have to ask about a history. You can look at what is the person's relationship in the present. And that will tell you what it is that they've brought from the past, because they're complaining about they're not happy campers in the present. But they have perfect backgrounds, but they have this horrific present. And I think it's that what that tells us what is pushed down. And I started to say that the third reason that I mentioned about difficulty in giving up need, the third reason is we have to accept that we lost, that what we deserve to have. One colleague wrote 10 commandments of every kid. Every kid has 10 commandments of what they deserve to have and what they ought to. If you're going to have a child, then you have this responsibility, like the Dalai Lama emphasized. But to give up that need is to accept that we lost, that what we wished we would have had, we lost. And we have to accept and grieve that loss. Footnote, there is no such thing as healing the inner child. I know there's a school that talks about it. There is no healing the inner child. There's a developing of the current adult who can grieve and mourn, I've used that image, the death of a child, because it is the death of that child's wishes that allows us to go on and grow. Because as long as we're going to hold on in the present to the past, hoping that we can change it, we're trapped in the past and not living in the present. The image that I have here is a general image. I call it the wedding picture, because in every relationship, every couple, there are four. Two adults in real time, and when I ask couples, well, what attracted you to one another, if I can get them to stop strangling one another, what attracted you? What brought you together? Something there must have been. It wasn't curly. It couldn't have been then what it is now. And they can list all of the things that they admire about their partner. But what they don't recognize is that nonverbal transmission of the past. I'm representing it as the triangle. We are inexorably drawn to the familiar. We find, in terms of nonverbal communication, our twin. We always marry our emotional twin. May have had totally different upbringings, may have had totally different paths, may have been different roads to Rome, but we always select to marry. May have dated a whole variety. You know, George, I can talk to any guy at all. I have no problem at all, but with you, I can never talk. And I point out, Helen, you didn't marry anybody but George. So sure, you can talk to anybody else, but how come you can't talk with George? So the point being that it is the specific that draws us, and that triangle is a representation of it. There's a little fine point to it I won't belabor at this point. So I'm fond of saying that marriages are not made in heaven. Marriage is made in childhood. And it is only through the awareness of our interaction with our spouse that we come to know so much more about ourselves. And if we can begin to look at, gee, why am I reacting this way? What's happening in my relationship? We begin to discover something unresolved about ourselves. We marry to find new battlefields upon which to fight old battles, only this time hoping to win. That's the flaw. So it's very much like taking a script and saying, geez, I don't like Hamlet. It's a tragedy. So I'll take the Hamlet script and I'll just cast a new lead in the, you know, people who have repetitive marriages often find themselves doing this. Same script, different lead. You know what? Curtain falls, it's still a tragedy. It's not until the script is changed that change can occur. It's a game, in a sense, called you lose. And I'm fond of saying that the only way you can win a game called you lose is not to play. The only way you can win a game called you lose is not to play. But not playing means you give up that old, early connection to survival, predictability, and have to accept loss and grieve that loss. Finally, and I'm watching the time, we can see how I expand this to the world stage. Because unfortunately, we see large children running around with AK-47s, and unfortunately with a satchel one of these times, believing, by the way, going back to analog versus digital, digital is where fundamentalism lives. It's my way is right, your way, if it's different, is wrong, it's bad, it has to be destroyed. So it's a powerful component in the, of what's happening, I think, in the world, and is frightening, because I think that the means of extermination have exponentially gone up. But that's another talk. To give you two quick clinical examples, a young lady was asked from a general audience on a hypnosis symposium to if there was any volunteers, and she came up and to participate in a hypnodrama. And she came on stage, and the therapist said, you're an extremely attractive young woman. And she was, dressed to the nines, beautiful, very obviously expensive kid leather, isn't it? High boots, a tailored skirt, lovely blouse, some jewelry, tasteful jewelry, really stunning. She said, oh, thank you very much. Everything I have on is stolen. Well, let me tell you, there was a murmur to say that. He said, I beg your pardon? Yes, everything I have, I've shoplifted. He said, do you realize it's not illegal? And she says, you think that's illegal? What these corporate capitalist pigs are doing to the working man is what's illegal. They deserve to be ripped off because they're ripping off the working man. So I'm entitled to have this. She went into a trance. She was an excellent subject. She went into a trance, went back to childhood. She was the fourth girl in a family of four girls, very poor family, hardly met expenses every month. Everything she ever owned was a hand-me-down. She had never owned anything new that she hadn't seen one of her sisters wearing. Even sometimes were worn out. What she incorporated in terms of home is a place where I don't ever have first class. I only have second class. If I want first class, I know it's wrong to steal, but I'll tell my adult the story, the fairy tale about capitalist pigs, and then I can shoplift. So you can see the power of the rationalization to keep alive that childhood. One quick, I'm going to go over 1 minute in terms of wanting to share with you a couple I saw. He came in, absolutely, he was an older gentleman, professional, absolutely exhausted. He looked exhausted. He barely brought himself to the office. He worked 2 full-time jobs and still had trouble making ends meet. He was a child in a family whose cousin was a world-famous personality whom he resembled uncannily, so much so that people came up to him thinking they were approaching the cousin and were very disappointed to find out he wasn't. But then they would ask, how was the cousin? Have no interest in him. So he never felt acknowledged for himself as a person. He was always living in the shadow of this gigantic personality that his cousin represented and was. Everyone in the world would recognize his cousin. And he looked, as I said, uncannily like him. He met and married a woman who was raised by a self-made multimillionaire who thought women, who was a, I suppose you could conservatively call him a male chauvinist pig, he treated his wife as trash. He treated his daughter as trash. He thought women had no value whatsoever. He had a son whom he showered all of his attention on and left the principal of a vast amount of money to, but left in trust for her, feeling that women are useless and incompetent anyway, left in trust for her the interest from the principal, which would then subsequently go to the brother. Every month she got a sizable check. Here's this husband who is desperate for some relief and had asked her, could you help a little bit with some of the bills? My father would never ask a woman. He did it himself. He accomplished it. She had totally idealized this monster. And what she did in the paradox of conflict, we always paint ourselves into the corner we're trying to stay out of. In the paradox of conflict, she went out and dissipated every penny that she got on useless junk that had no value ultimately, or clothing that she could never wear, shoes galore, never could take even out of them, never have 10 lifetimes to wear all of this material, and her husband struggling. So what was their twinship? Being ignored as children, being devalued, having no sense of self. That's what drew them together in this powerful nonverbal communication. And it's what then got manifested in terms of the conflict that they presented. I'm going to respect the time, which I've already gone over a couple of minutes, and leave some time for the questions. I do have one thing that I do want to say, and that is to express a wish for you. My wish for you is that you know what you need, but have what you want. Thank you. I think there's a microphone somewhere, or somebody have a question? Yes. Very similar. I think it's a very good point. I think there are a number of... What I've presented to you is my distillation. People have certainly asked me about what school you are. And my answer, and I point out to them that it is as authentic an answer as I could... Are you Freudian? Are you Jungian? Are you Maslowian? My answer is I'm Carnarian. I've taken every piece of anything that seems to fit. And I'm fond of saying, I don't care if we burn incense during the session. If it will help get rid of what's haunting you, We'll do it. We'll burn incense. Because I think, again, what works is what I'm looking for. And what I've come to over the years is this formulation that I share with patients. What I've shared with you, as I was telling Dr. O'Reilly, my lectures to students of all disciplines, I've lectured to all disciplines in mental health, is no different than what I've shared with you. Eric Byrne, by the way, said something brilliant that I meant to put in childhood, but Byrne came to mind because he was Byrne had a comment that almost all texts in science, but in psychiatry, are written in Martian. Very few are written in English. And those of you who have read Byrne know how easily read his stuff is. Games People Play is the most famous. But Byrne said, being a child is, he says, what happens when you don't follow your notes like your wife tells you. Byrne said, being a child, thank you, is like being a midget in the land of giants. You have to believe they know where they're stepping, or you cannot get a moment's rest. And if you're stepped on, you have to believe it was your fault for being underfoot, not that they didn't know what they were doing. Because how do you survive with the awareness that the people upon whom I depend to survive don't know what the hell they're doing? So instead, and we see this spontaneously when couples divorce. 4 or 5-year-olds will say, Mommy and Daddy are getting a divorce because I wet my bed. Mommy and Daddy are getting a divorce because I didn't finish my peas and carrots. They will internalize. They will take any of the badness away from the parent figure, internalize it. And then I've suggested, this is beyond the question, but I'm using it as a springboard, that prejudice comes from, I think there's an element that we hereditarily or environmentally, the us-them phenomenon, I think is very powerful because us means we're safe, them means they're foreign and we may not be safe. But the root of prejudice is to take that not okayness from our parenting figures into ourselves. And then if it's too painful to keep it in ourselves, dump it off on somebody we can identify easily. If they're a different color, a different creed, if they live in a different neighborhood. I grew up on Fullerton, and there was a Fullerton gang, and we were better than the Sturtevant gang, which was next block over. By gangs, please understand, we're talking pretty mild stuff, not talking about current connotations of gang, but the whole idea of how important it was to feel that sense of we're okay and somebody is lesser. And I think that's the profound element of prejudice, is trying to take something so painful about ourselves and dump it off on somebody else. Yes. I'm not quite sure I'm understanding.
Okay, so a hug is worth this much. A pat on the head is worth that much.
Oh, I see.
A kiss is this much. I mean, whatever a parent might do for the child.
Yeah.
When they're babies and they don't really talk to you.
Right.
Have you seen any of
that? There's a very good point you're making, because infant observations, of which there's been an enormous number. The first one started in the 1700s by a guy named Tillemann, and I outline it. But there have been a number of researchers, but now it's taken off like wildfire. And we're seeing a merging of psychiatry, psychology, neurosurgery, neurology. It's all coming together. And one of the things that is extremely important is what's called attunement. An infant can be overwhelmed unless a mother backs off. The infant gives a signal that they can't take more stimulation. It's the empathic mother who can then back off and is available to reconnect. So the point, if that's a general way of trying to answer what you're asking, because if the parent is avoidant completely, we have a problem. About 70% of kids, fortunately, have what are called secure attachments, but then we have chaotic and avoidant. I think it is the sensitivity to the individual child that is so crucial. Some need, when you think about Graydon, the wonderful autistic lady who's the animal specialist. Yeah, what's her name? Graydon. What she desperately needed was to be held, but she couldn't stand it from human contact. And when she was on her grandfather's ranch, I think it was, she got inside the machine that held cattle and for the first time felt safe, relaxed. So that's an extreme example of someone who desperately needed to be touched but couldn't stand a human touch but desperately needed the touch. And I think the sensitivity is being aware of what that infant needs and being able to provide it and not over provide it. It's interesting that problems develop two different ways. Freud identified this. One way is that we're commonly aware of is by deprivation. Take something away from somebody, neglect them, abuse them, deprive them. But Freud identified a second way in which development is thwarted, and that's indulgence. You can overindulge. And a colleague some years ago wrote a book about children of the slums, children of the rich. And he showed they were virtually developmentally the same. Because one was arrived at a developmental arrest by deprivation, one by overindulgence. So it is finding that balance. And I joke that, as I showed you the slide, and that mothers are conducting bloodless neurosurgery on their infants. They are changing the actual brain of their infants in the interactions. So with usually the only training is that they've had themselves as kids. So it's awesome that we are, at least have survived thus far as a species. Is there a mic? Do you have a mic? I'm having trouble hearing the...
You familiar with, I'm sure you
are. I don't think it's on. Oh, it is? Okay.
Is that better?
Okay, there you go.
The plastic nature of the brain. So one of the things you talked about just now was this neurosurgery that mothers are conducting on. So the children are like sponges. They just respond to that interaction. But there's a point in time where that ends, or it's not as active anymore. So when is the age when that ceases to be the case, where the brain doesn't respond as rapidly or actively?
A woman wrote a book that I never read, but the title of which was wonderful, but I read the review of it. So Once My Child, Now My Friend. And in it, what she was emphasizing is that you gradually are investing responsibility and privilege in relationship to the capacity that child has to accept. You can over-privilege them. You can over-gratify. But the idea is to be able to, or you can give them too much responsibility. The latchkey kid at age 5, there are such stories. So we gradually are looking for investing responsibility and privilege consistent with the capacities and development of that child. So there's nothing off the rack. Everything is custom made. And that, I think, is extremely important to be sensitive to. Anybody who has more than one child knows they come totally, as I said, different from the factory. Every kid is different. Yeah. Could you use the mic?
Could you talk about the public policy ramifications of some of what you said? I'm interested in if you simplistically take people who think like children and people like think like adults, and most of the country and most of the world thinks like children. If I'm a policymaker, it seems rational to talk to them like children, even if that's not the best thing to do. And so there would be confusion as to, is the person a child or are they an adult? So how do you think about in mass kind of educating the public to think like adults?
Yeah, I think that it parallels somewhat, and I'm glad you're thinking in terms of an interest in terms of policy making. I had the privilege of being able to forward a book to a fellow. My wife is Swedish, and we were in Sweden on a farm, and a farm guy came by and began speaking to me in English, and it was just wonderful because I was sort of isolated. I don't speak Swedish as much as I tried. And I said, your English is flawless. I said, where did you learn? Oh, he said, I lived in and worked in the United States. I said, well, what did you do? He said, well, I was Sweden's ambassador to the United States. So it was quite a privilege to send him a copy of the book, and we talked about exactly this, that so much of our political system is binary. So much of the relationships between, and unfortunately, if you look at the headlines now, and there's all kinds of ramifications, but Gaza and Israel, we have a situation where there's polarization. However it came about, there's no middle ground. We're desperately trying to find an analog solution to what has been a binary knee-jerk reaction. Look anywhere in the world and you see a repetition of that pattern. So I think that what is important is to begin to help kids to accept greater degrees of uncertainty, to realize there is no such thing as a mistake. A mistake is an opportunity, as a Nobel laureate said, to learn what doesn't work. And if kids can be raised without a fear of making mistakes, if we can raise kids saying, you know, I don't know what will come along your way, but I know you can handle it, and you will learn from the process and grow as a result of it. That, I think, is quintessentially what we have to try to do in human relationships. It's going to be vitally important to see what happens with this lame duck Congress. How much will they remain in a binary mode? Who will step forward into an analog capacity? And I think in policy making, that's vital. But it means being willing to accept a degree of uncertainty, giving up things that we believed in as absolute foundations, and risking the step forward. If we don't, then I think there's great concern for the race. Yes?
Let's say a child had a very physically abusive and emotionally abusive mother. And there were no other siblings, and the father wasn't around, so the only child bore the full brunt of this. And the child's strategy was to, at a certain age, utterly, emotionally cut themselves off from the mother, and basically never told the mother anything personal about themselves or where they worked or what they did or whatever
right.
for the rest of their life. So that's what happened, and that was the coping strategy. What's your best advice for that? Because obviously the past can't be undone. Memories survive. If one goes to therapy, one just describes
Give me a chance to emphasize an important point. What is extremely important, one of the roles of therapy, is to help people develop a cohesive narrative of their life. So one of the goals with that person would be to help them to have a cohesive narrative. That is, to be able to understand, just as nations develop cohesive narratives, we as a nation have an incredible mythology, starting with Thanksgiving, how well we treated the natives, all the way out to the West Coast. So we have this tremendous mythology. That's our myth of our nation's identity. What's important is you function when you can have a creative, or a cohesive rather, identity. A cohesive narrative. So to help this person understand they were not at fault. They were unfortunate victims of someone who themselves, and I often do that, is, do you know anything about your grandmother and grandfather? Because your mom as much as she may have seemed like a giant monster, was once a little bitty kid. Do you know about her parents? And what was it like for her as a kid growing up? Because I can tell you it was not different from the way she raised you. And one of the phenomenal things about a cohesive narrative, women who do not have it, who have had that kind of a background, are unable to nurture their newborn. Women who have been helped to develop a cohesive narrative about their life, as horrific as it may have been, are able to nurture their newborn. That's traumatic. One more? Oh, yes.
Do you have an explanation for this? I think I've heard that there's a rising incidence of sociopathic personalities in our society nowadays. And to what would you attribute that increase?
Well, there's certainly a vast difference between a criminal aspect and psychopathy. And those people we know very little about because they don't hold still very long. If they're in jail, you have a chance to do a little more of a studying, but we don't have much information about them. Sociopathy, I regret, and I guess going back to last year's book about the age of narcissism, I think there's been a sense of indulgence, a me generation that's been argued about. I think I think that's a contributing factor. I think if we look at some of the people who go into the political world, there's a degree to which they are no longer, as much as there was squabbling among the founding fathers, they were a remarkable group of people who came together. They were citizens who contributed their time. Now we have professionals who have to raise money, we had a candidate recently who will tell an audience or would tell an audience whatever the audience wanted to hear, and then would change it with the audience. So that is a way of... We also see a rising rate of cheating as normal in colleges, and it's a rising problem. So I think there is something we have to address. And Rabbi Hillel, a rabbi who lived 2,000 years ago, and I quoted in the book, I have never heard a shrink say it better than Hillel said it. If I'm not for myself, who will be? But if I'm only for myself, what am I? If not now, when? I think that's an anecdote to the narcissism. A lot of people, if I'm not for myself, who will be? So I'll be for myself, and the hell with you. But if I'm only for myself, what am I? Narcissistic, psychopathic, sociopathic? If not now, when? So I think that's an anecdote to it. Those of you who saw the program on 60 Minutes know that kids come hardwired with morality, and that is absolutely, as I mentioned. So it's a matter of trying to foster and encourage that, and society can devalue it. There's a LA Times has today and yesterday a young man who unfortunately stayed out of gangs, bright kid, was shot in a drive-by by someone he recognized, paralyzed, and said a good Christian, and he is, does not lie. I have to testify. Now, that's a front page story in the LA Times because of the power of the drama, of a willingness to put his life on the line to say, he shot me. And there are consequences for that. And it's that kind of heroism that we have to see more people encouraged to engage in.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Gardner. That was excellent.
Thank you.
I thoroughly enjoyed this, and if you have some few minutes, if you wanted to be out here, if anybody
Absolutely.
Else any questions for you, they can ask you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.